The views and opinions expressed here are those of the guests and are not the official position of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
One of the most remarkable aspects of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. We're in the Mormon Channel studio today visiting with a legacy of audiovisual history. I can just say that right up front because we have easily over 100 years of experience from a very recent church audiovisual department. In studio, we have Quinn Orr, who is an Emmy Award-winning producer-director. He grew up on a farm in southern Alberta. He served as a missionary in the French-speaking Belgium Brussels mission from 77 to 79 and later graduated from the BYU Film School with a master's degree in instructional media design and evaluation. He has just celebrated 25 years with the audiovisual department. His current assignment is the supervisor of international film and video. We have online on the phone with us Bob Collins. He's hello, Bob.
Hello, everyone.
All right. He grew up in Ogden, Utah, and now lives in Bountiful, Utah. He served a mission in Ohio, served in the U.S. Navy. He graduated from BYU twice with a Bachelor's of Arts in Broadcasting, a Master of Arts in Non-Commercial Media. Bob has worked for the church for over 33 years, most of that time in audiovisual production. Also, we have Tim Taggart with us, who grew up in Logan, Utah. He graduated with a Bachelor and Master's degrees from Utah State University. He has produced media for the church for about 25 years now. He currently works in the audiovisual department as Assistant Director of Production Services and Manager of Language Production and Area Support Services. And our last guest today is Bill Schaefermeyer. Bill was born in San Diego, California, grew up in Vernal and Seward, Alaska. He received bachelor and master's degrees from BYU, taught seminary for 8 years. For 8 years, wrote and published Old Testament and church history curriculum for CES. Before his retirement in 2008, he worked in the church audiovisual department for 24 years, where he served as director of development and production, director of LDS Motion Picture Studio in Provo, and director of the Conference Center Studio and Broadcast Center in Salt Lake City. Bill and his wife Sharon have recently accepted a call to serve as missionaries in the England, London, South Mission. Brethren, thank you very much for joining with us today.
Great to be with you.
Happy to be with you.
To start things, thank you. To start things off, perhaps to get a perspective on church audiovisual history, I understand there's a story of Reed Smoot and a broadcast that happened from New York to San Francisco. Tim, would you mind telling us that story?
Well, Reed Smoot, of course, when he was serving as a member of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, was also elected to be a senator from Utah and served from 1903 to 1933. But when he was a young boy, his mother took him in Provo to a sermon given by the president of the church, Brigham Young. And in that sermon, Brigham Young made a prophecy. He said that the day would come when the human voice would be heard from New York to San Francisco. And on the way home from that, young boy Reed turned to his mother and he said, "That was a big lie. That's impossible and it couldn't be." And his mother turned to him and said, "You will live to see the fulfillment of what the president has said today." Of course, later in later years, as time went by, they created a national broadcasting system where you could speak from New York to San Francisco. And one of his colleagues that was responsible for this effort invited Reed Smoot to come to New York City, where he would be the first man to speak over this system from New York City to San Francisco.
So not only did he live to see it, he lived to eat his words on the air.
And he literally fulfilled the prophecy that he said couldn't be.
That's a great story.
Ironic.
I think the Lord has a great sense of humor.
So let's talk about the evolution of audiovisual in the church. I've always heard that it was Gordon B. Hinckley who started audiovisual in the church. Is that true or not true? Bill, do you have a perspective on that?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt that he was one of the major players in audiovisual in the church. Prior to him coming home from his mission, which is well known that he was hired immediately by the church, prior to that, there were photographers around and movie makers and that sort of thing, but not a concentrated effort. And he kind of had the job of doing missionary work using media. And so I guess just him and a cameraman, and he would just go out and get media.
He wrote the scripts.
He wrote the scripts.
The Fullness of Time series was a classic that was done in the 30s that he actually went to Hollywood. He wrote all the scripts and then went to Hollywood, and they hired the best audio talent of the day, radio broadcasters, and created a radio drama that to this day is still, you can still listen to it and find very engaging. Music's a little bit hokey on the front coming from the 30s, but it's still great scripts and excellent production.
Exactly. When we were doing the video bio of him when he was just before he became the president of the church, Russ Holt and I were able to go down. I think maybe Lyle Shammo, who was our managing director, was also there. We got to go down and poke around in his storage unit in the administration building looking for that series. And it was fun just to kind of see all of the media material that had his name on it.
Yeah.
So there's no question about it.
He wrote much of the music and the spoken word broadcast messages, working directly with Richard L. Evans, and for many years was the producer of the program every Sunday morning. He was the producer that ran the show.
And I think it's okay to say that he was involved in the temple stuff, because that's been published. I mean, the very fact that he was one of the first to put the temple material on media. And
he was the director.
Yeah.
One of the things that's interesting to me is when he first had the job, how they gave him this little room, and he had to go find his own desk.
And typewriter. And paper.
And had next to nothing. And yet, we talk about it's not the camera that makes great images, it's who's behind the camera.
Yeah.
And I think that was an example. So many times in church media, we try to do things and have such limited resources, but the Spirit has plans, and it goes beyond whatever limitations we have.
One should mention that while we're talking about audiovisual, he was also the first missionary department, the first family history department. I mean, he was the full-time staffer that did all of these things.
So he was a major.
I also.
Go ahead, Bob. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say I just had a thought that he was also hand-tinting film strips, hand-coloring film strips frame by frame individually. At that time, too. Quite a tedious job, but somebody had to do it.
There was nothing he didn't do, is what it sounds like.
And I think it's interesting that in the development of the audiovisual department, he was in the middle of that every step of the way.
Absolutely.
And the first chairman of the audiovisual committee for the church.
And served there for many years.
So speaking of the creation of the audiovisual department, what did departments do before there was a consolidated effort to get media all in one department?
Well, let me jump in on that one. There's a bit of history that I'm always fascinated with, and that's the history of the motion picture studio down in Provo. During World War II, they kind of invented the instructional media, the idea that you could train large numbers of people using films. And the president, this wasn't lost on the president of the church at this time, and they had asked the Whitaker brothers, who were working in Los Angeles at the time, working on films for Disney, to see if they would head up a church film unit. And that evolved into the facility that was near Brigham Young University. And when they would do films for church departments. So the idea of the Sunday school needing something, they would go down to the Whitakers and they would put together a script or a concept and then go film the thing. And is it Wetzel Whitaker? Judge Whitaker has written this history of his 20 years making films for the church, and it's fascinating. And again, you know, the struggling with lack of resources and so forth, and yet making such a great difference with what they did.
Yeah, their first studio was on the campus where the Wilkinson Center was. They called it the Green Barn, I think, because that was the color of it, and it wasn't soundproof. And so anytime they had sound recording, they had to do it in the middle of the night, two to three. I mean, they would put up signs recording and please be quiet. And seems like that's when the hot rodders would race their engines and honk their horns and stuff like that. So they had to do it in the middle of the night. They had limited resources.
Bob, what were you going to say?
As long as we're talking about history, too, of church audiovisual, it should be mentioned that the Claussen brothers were early pioneers in church film. They shot a lot of church film, but a lot of it was lost in a fire later on. And we don't have very much of their stuff left over. And they weren't employees of the church either. So that was an earlier effort that in church audiovisual. That's probably the start of church motion pictures.
Yeah, that was the 1920s, I believe, when that occurred.
Yeah.
And they were shooting on silver nitrate film, which, you know, was highly flammable. And we read of the tragedy of one of them being killed in the fire, of the two brothers, and it kind of put an end to it. And all the great images they had, because they used to film the prophets and the apostles and so forth, and much of that was lost. We have a few things left, but a lot of history was lost in that fire.
Right.
In answer to your question about what departments used to do, there was every department was kind of on their own. So physical facilities had a little video studio in the back of the main floor auditorium where they did some limiting editing and little productions for themselves. In CES, Bill and I were in CES along with Lyle Shammo, and we had our own cameras, a little set up across the street in the old school that used to be the MTC. We had a little editing facility over there. Everyone was kind of on their own. Missionary did their efforts mostly using Bonneville. Public Affairs had their own people. Bob was a part of that effort with exhibits and that sort of thing in Public Affairs.
And Dean Fotheringham over in Welfare, he had an edit system.
And later I came to the curriculum department, and they did their own thing. And we would hire Bonneville or the BYU people to help us do film strips or whatever else we needed.
So all of that kind of came together.
And other people.
All of that kind of came together when audiovisual was consolidated from many of the departments to the curriculum department. And that was, what, 1983?
1984.
Yep. What brought that about? Who wanted that to happen?
Well, we have a signed letter by President Kimball.
Yeah.
The first presidency at that time, President Kimball and President, President Hinckley, and I can't remember, I think it was President Romney signed that first letter in 1984 announcing the audiovisual division of the curriculum department.
And part of the purpose was to avoid duplication, to save money, and to eliminate all of the duplication and overlap in so many of the places. And all of us were all a part of that consolidation that came together at that point in the curriculum department.
I'm probably the exception to the rule.
I was actually hired immediately after.
As part of that. Everyone else had been moved in. I'm the kid in the group here.
Well,
I've only been with the church 25 years now. I'm the young guy.
Yeah. Well, Bob kind of had a media degree, but Quinn's degree was actually in film. So he was our first real film professional in the department.
Let's discuss the organization of the audiovisual department.
1991.
Let me give a brief history, starting from the beginning. We can edit it. You can jump in anytime that you want. One of the fun stories is when I was teaching seminary, I had hired Lyle and later Tim to come in for CES. Then I went back out teaching seminary, and those two guys became part of the division of the curriculum department in 1984 and called and asked that I come and work with them. And the first thing that happened, as I remember, is Tim took me up to meet Bob Collins, and Bob Collins approved whether or not I could come to work.
So and he's been mad at me ever since.
So that was a fun time. We were a small group of people, 27 as it got rolled out, small group of people trying to make everything work. And so from 1984 to 1991, we functioned as a division of the curriculum department. Then in 1991, after a history that a whole bunch of meetings and stuff that that went on that we won't take time to discuss, but the audiovisual department was organized again by the first presidency, President Hinckley. It was President Benson, I'm pretty sure, at that time, 1991.
Yeah, yep. It was.
And President Hinckley was his counselor, and then President Monson. And so those three signed the document that made the audiovisual department with Lyle Shammell as the managing director and James M. Paramore as the executive director of the department. And so... at that time, the motion picture studio, the BYU motion picture studio, under the direction of President Hinckley, was brought into the church audiovisual department and became the LDS motion picture studio. And it was also determined that the group working on temple media would also be brought into the department. There was some discussion about whether they should be kept separate, but they were brought into the department as well. And so the department was organized at that time.
So there were people in other departments doing audiovisual work. What happened to them?
Well, with the organization of the audiovisual department, basically all of that came together for the first time. So public affairs media, missionary media, basically all audiovisual aspects of the church. All audiovisual work was to be done by or under direction of the audiovisual department. So the brethren basically got their arms around all of the media the aspects and brought it together. So all the budgets would now be under the audiovisual department.
And we got some people from the other department to sign to our department too.
Right. Yep.
So we know with the Claussen brothers and the Whitakers and that the church is not the only ones who have actually produced films about the church. How do we know if it's a church-produced film? Looking at it, how can you tell?
I've got an easy way for that. There's no credits.
That's right. At the end of the film, there won't be any credits.
So tell me about the credits philosophy that emerged in the audiovisual department.
Well, we determined...
But there used to be.
Well, all of the old BYU films always had credits on them. You could always tell when those were produced by the church because it always said, produced under the direction of the First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles on the beginning of the
end.
And the end was
that
on the
was
end.
It.
Yeah. But we determined when we were consolidated together that we really wanted – we didn't want to draw attention to ourselves and the people that were working on the films. It really needed to be a focus on the message. And so we made the determination at that point that we would not put credits on any of the films that we produced. And to this day, we still are not putting credits on any of the church films.
And as I recall, it wasn't just us. It was a correlation helped decision also.
Well, I think they approved it. But I think we generated the policy.
Yeah, we kind of, amongst ourselves, sometimes we say we're the invisible men. You know, it's, you do so many projects over and over. I sat down and figured out I've probably worked on over 200 projects, films, while I've been here. And your name doesn't show up, and I'm fine with that. But, you know, if you're looking for a credit, you don't come working here because that's not why you do it.
I have a story about my mother who was complaining. Now, I never see your name on these films. And I said, Mother, with you around, I don't need my name on those.
So we try to emphasize the message of the media, what it's supposed to be all about. Is there some specific story any of you can share about a specific project where the Spirit told you to do something that maybe wasn't in the plan?
Wow. Well, here's a story. We were commissioned by the Relief Society to do a film. They wanted to promote the idea of family, and they wanted to have this film that would take up 7 or 8 minutes that they were going to use in the General Relief Society broadcast. And this was 10, 15 years ago. And so we went out, we filmed, we went across the country, we found people, we edited the thing, we brought it back. And when it went through and for approval, they went, no, this isn't right, this isn't right. Right up to the deadline, and we were saying, oh, my gosh, you know, we've done everything. We thought we were on track here. And this is a really important issue. What are we going to do? And finally they said, we're just going to drop it. We're just not going to do it. And then they came to me afterwards, and they said, we just met with President Hinckley. And he said, I've got this document I've been working on, and it's a proclamation about the family. Would you have an extra 7 or 8 minutes in the broadcast that I could take so I can read this? And we went, yeah, we've got it. And so, you know, we were both working on the same thing, but kind of that, this isn't the right thing, left that space. Now, you know, it's probably not a big thing. If you wanted 7 or 8 minutes, they'd make it happen. But nevertheless, it kind of came together at the end. My role in the proclamation of the family was creating the hole that it went into.
So your lack of success
Yes.
was highly successful. I used to have a name for that as a stake president. I called it inspired stupidity. Yeah. You know, when you continually forget something and then you discover why it is that it was so important that you didn't do that.
You know, there's so many times in productions where things just kind of seem to come together. I mean, Gary Cook, when he was working on the Joseph film, talks about they really wanted to get this dramatic shot in the Sacred Grove, and things just weren't working out. The lighting was bad, and on the very last day, everything just kind of came together.
Yeah.
And just happens, seems to happen quite often in our business.
I had that experience actually in San Diego where we were trying to get footage of families doing things. And we'd been there for 3 or 4 days. And it seemed like everything we tried to do just didn't work. And finally, I said, okay, I sent everybody home. And we kept just a couple people. And I said, I got one more chance. You know, we contacted a ward and asked for volunteers. And this one family volunteered to come do footage with us. And they took us up to a place called Lake Helix, which is this absolutely beautiful setting. And we filmed there for 3 or 4 hours and got more than we did the entire first few days of them fishing and ducks following the mom. It's a shot that's been used a lot. And sometimes you just have to tough it out to the end, and then you see it all come together.
After the trial of your faith.
Yeah, exactly.
And sometimes weather doesn't cooperate until the last minute, and sometimes it doesn't cooperate at all, and then it turns out to be for the best anyway.
Yeah,
we had I don't mean to hog the mic here, but we just had an experience where we were filming, had gone up to the River Ribble, where they had the first baptisms in England. We were shooting stock footage, trying to document these places. And the weather had been bad, and it had been raining, but, you know, we prayed that we'd be blessed that day, and we go out and I'm standing out in the rain with covers on, waiting for a break in the weather, you know, trying to show my faith and trying to get what we need to do, and it just comes down harder. And so we've all, our small group had kind of retreated under a tree, and one of the people on the crew said, we had these missionaries with us who were showing us the locations because we weren't familiar with the area and they could get us around quicker. And so somebody said, well, let's have one of the missionaries pray. And so this elder gets up and prays that, you know, we'll have good weather and we'll have sunshine, and finishes very specific prayer. And in 5 minutes, not only did the rain stop, but the clouds cleared, the sun came out, we had sun the rest of the day. And it was something we'd struggled with the whole time. And it was just, it was amazing.
And with the moisture on the trees and grass, it probably looked fabulous.
And the air is clear. We don't have haze, you know, all these great things. And it was just like, okay, sometimes you got to be really specific. And the help is there.
And the Lord is the best art director.
Yeah.
He does really great skies and other things.
I don't know when we want to mention the Sandy Andy project.
Oh,
that was such a fun thing. On December 1st, I wrote it down in my journal, on December 1st, 1999, prior to the Christmas devotional by the brethren, this was a Wednesday, and they were going to have the Christmas devotional on Sunday.
Now, let me jump in here. One of my favorite things about devotionals and conference is that as a producer, you're called on deck, and it's your job that whatever they decide to visualize, you just go and do it. You've only got one or two or three days to do this project. And some people don't like that type. I happen to love it because the doors are open for you and you get this fun assignment. And so I was on deck on ready for the Christmas devotional.
And so we got word about noon on Wednesday that President Faust wanted to have some of his talk illustrated. And when he was a boy, he wanted a Sandy Andy machine. And so he wanted to know if we could get a photograph of
that. You want to describe what a Sandy Andy is for our listeners, Bill?
Well, I was the only one around old enough to remember what a Sandy Andy was. I knew what it was. It's kind of one of those perpetual motion toys where you put sand in the hopper and a little car goes up by a counterweight, fills up with sand, which makes it heavier now than the counterweight, and it goes down and empties the sand and then goes back up. Back and forth, back and forth. It's just a fascinating machine to watch. So I called Quinn and said, Quinn, this is what we got. Why don't you find out if you can find a Sandy Andy machine?
So this comes from the 30s or 20s, doesn't it?
Yeah. Right, right.
Yeah. Yep. So, well,
and this was in the early days where Internet was just a new thing, and I had just acquired an account on eBay, this new thing called eBay, okay? So we didn't have Internet anywhere in the building except in the library. And so I had to go over to the library, and I thought, and so I searched this thing out and found one, and it's in Colorado for sale. But if you're familiar with eBay, you know it's got so many days that it has to be up for sale before they can give it to you. And so I'm sending off these emails to the sellers saying, we desperately need this. You know, name us a price. Do something. And hoping that they would respond. Meanwhile, the people in the library are saying, you know, we got to lock up here at a certain point. And so I sent the messages, and they locked up, and it was evening, and I just went back to my office to wait.
So he calls me on a new technology that we're just now getting called a cell phone, you know. And I'm on my way home. I've located one. It's in Colorado Springs. The lady says that she won't give it to us or won't ship it to us until we have the money. And I'm saying, oh, wow, how are we going to get this? And I had just been in Colorado Springs not too long ago filming for the brethren there, a devotional. And so I thought, oh, man, I could call a bishop or a stake president. I mean, you know, this is a big church. And then all of a sudden I realized I know who the institute director is there, John Hassler. So I had his number, called him on the cell phone, said, John, how much money you got?
And this is why you're driving home from work.
That's right. While we're going home from work. And so I told him what we needed, and I said, we'll pay you back. You just go over and contact this lady, give her the money, and get that sent off.
Yeah.
And we got it.
What happened? So he pays her and goes to the airport because we didn't have overnight stuff at that point that was reliable, and puts it on a plane. And I'm preparing for the rest of the shoot down in Provo, and we send a production assistant up to the Salt Lake Airport, and she picks it up and brings it down to us, and it doesn't work. And so we're kind of looking at this thing. So I pull out a pair of pliers and spend an hour or two fooling around with it and got it so it was working and filled it up. And the next day we shot the scene. And so this was Friday.
You used your son to fill in for President Faust as a boy. And he's looking through this window that's all Christmassy, and it's just...
Yeah, and it's the old, it was the old, what they call the Western Town set on the back lot of the Motion Picture Studio, which doesn't exist anymore. It's been replaced by the Kirtland set. But we had this, you know, wood sidewalk, old building type look that was believable for the 30s, and set it up in the front window and shot it, and that thing worked like a charm.
It was great.
The audience would not have understood what a Sandy Andy was without those visuals.
Yeah. And people still remember that. People still remember the Sandy Andy piece from the Christmas devotional years ago.
And didn't we give him the Sandy Andy afterwards?
We gave it to him.
Yeah. And he was so thrilled, wasn't he?
Well, he had to set it up right on the desk.
He
but,
did.
President, it's messy. That's okay. That's what we have.
I know. We filled it with sand, and it's dumping sand all over his desk. It was a great moment. It was just fun.
We're talking about the history of audiovisual in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We have Tim Taggart, Quinn Orr, Bill Schaefermeyer, and Bob Collins visiting with us in studio today. We all know about media in the world out there and how media is done. And there's a lot of good, but there's a lot of not so good, too. What are some of the main differences, besides what we've been talking about with the Spirit, etc., between media that we do and the media out there? Anybody got an idea?
I'd like Bob to respond to this. He and I went to a... workshop in Rockport, Maine, together, and we took some of our visuals with us. You remember that, Bob? What was the reaction of the people that we were showing those to?
Well, they were amazed that a church would have a production outfit like we did, and then, of course, they were not used to dealing with the same subject matter as we did, and it was so strange to them that we were not into it for a commercial purpose, but for teaching only. And so the subject matter, I think, was a great divider.
Several of them said to me, I spend all my time selling toothpaste or drapes or something with commercials. That's what we... It'd be so nice to be involved in something that really made a difference.
Something that really matters.
One of the other things, too, that I think sets us apart, I've worked somewhat on the entertainment side, and one of the biggest things that I noticed is that in entertainment, all you have to do is get people's attention. If they're entertained or if they're fascinated, you've done your job. But so much of what we do in the church, we're trying to move people. We're trying to teach them. You know, we talk about... that parables are really kind of the media of the old world, where the Savior would tell a story and then at the end ask a question, and then they would have a discussion and people would learn from it. And we often use that model that we're trying to accomplish something here other than just fascinate people. Sometimes people will come to us saying, you know, why doesn't the church, you know, invest in motion pictures that are good entertainment? And I think the answer has to be we've got our hands full just trying to teach.
And if entertainment comes along the way, that's gravy on the potatoes, but that's not the main purpose.
And one of the most important things, I think, about the work of the church with audiovisual is the fact that the Holy Ghost can witness to people through media. In other words, the power of testimony and the power of the Spirit to open people's minds and teach things is not limited to face-to-face contact, which is the power of general conference. Even though the people aren't in the audience, they experience the same experience, in some cases, a more enhanced experience because they see the face closer, they get the nonverbal elements, but the Spirit has the capacity to be transferred from the Holy Ghost to the hearts of the children of men through the power of media. And because of that, there's an opportunity that comes as the brethren design and craft messages that can be conveyed through the media that provides in our day and age an economy of scale to be able to reach millions of people in every language across the earth. and it's a sign of the times and the accomplishment of prophecies that to those who heard them, I'm sure, seemed impossible, that the word would go to every tongue, to every people, to every land, seemed impossible, and it seemed hyperbole. But in our day, we see where that literally occurs because of the power of media to convey the Holy Ghost.
Yeah, my
like Reed Smoot.
Just like Reed Smoot. My son, living in downtown Manhattan, sent me an email right after General Conference telling me what a marvelous experience he had in his own room watching that on the Internet.
Yeah.
And how he felt the Spirit and felt exactly what you were talking about. And that can happen anywhere in the world.
Yeah. Whether you're gathered together in a small group in Cambodia, in South Africa, or anywhere else in the world, we now have the living words of the prophet conveyed in some 97 languages into the hearts and minds through the power of the Holy Ghost to people everywhere in the world. That's powerful.
So the power of the word can not only be conveyed through, say, the scriptures, book.
Yeah.
It can also be done through media as well.
Yeah. And in many cases, it provides a way for people to understand the words of the book. In some cases, people have difficulty with words, with reading and other things. And so many times the media provides a groundwork so that they now can open up the scriptures and understand the words, and the Spirit can teach them even more as it begins to open up. And it's a process for people.
You know, and I think that was one of the difficulties during the Meridian Church,
yeah,
is that the apostles just could not get every place that they needed to at once to counteract the false doctrines of the devil.
Keeping the church together was the major problem of the Meridian of Times, and it is the major challenge of our day. But there is no church on earth that is able to be unified like ours because of the power of the media and communication.
You know, there's another issue, too, as I've gone through the scriptures and looked at the church of that time. We had the brethren would come and teach, and it would move them, and they would feel the Spirit. And then so often, both in Book of Mormon and New Testament, they say, what shall we do?
Yeah.
What shall we do? It's like, okay, I feel it, I know it, but now I need to integrate, and I need to be taught that. And that's another model that we kind of follow through, is that you move people by the Spirit, and then you teach them their responsibility and what to do in their life and so forth. And that's another big role we have as well.
And so many places that we go in the world, I talked to a stake president in Latin America who said, there's not a man in this country who's ever trained himself to do anything by reading. Just show us what to do, and we'll do it. And so there is an enhanced responsibility for us to convey to people the concepts and the ideas of what is expected of a Latter-day Saint, of a leader, a parent, a member of the church, in a mediated way that allows them to act on the impressions of the Spirit that they receive.
We're talking with Bill Schaefermeyer, Tim Taggart, Bob Collins, and Quinn Orr discussing the history of church media. This is such a great topic, and we've got such fascinating stories to tell. We're going to split this up into two episodes. Join us next time on Legacy for Part 2.